Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa Aparuta De Sangamatasa Taura Ye Sorabanta Bamunjantu Sadang. So this has been the first week of this winter's retreat, and an amazing week, actually, because for me, and this beautiful weather, the light in the afternoon, walking out in the field, and the kind of sharp, crisp, cold, frosty, and yet sunny weather, and I really enjoyed it. There's a strange kind of feeling, actually, this year. So many kind of conflicts and seemingly unresolvable problems have been resolved, so that, of course, is very good to see. And so conflict is something to, you know, it happens internally and externally in so many different ways because of the nature of this realm that we live in. So like Ajahn Manindra and I have not been on very good terms for about 10 years. So this has been, we spent the past week here and the kind of deeper understanding and for each other and respect definitely taken place. So that I think is a very good sign for the Sangha in England, because that was one of the distressing factors, I think, for all of us, was the kind of conflict between he and myself. When it happens at the top, it definitely has affects everybody, whether they like it or not. So in these kind of things, we don't want conflict, but yet these arise. And I can see myself with a strong desire to resolve the conflict very quickly, but because I didn't like it. But then it didn't seem to work, and just on the level of wanting to get rid of it by whatever, talking or whatever, things did happen seemed to exacerbate the conflict. So then I began to realize that one had to maybe be more patient and trusting and waiting, rather than just impulsively, idealistically wanting to get, to solve a problem. With meditation, isn't it, we'd like to go to nirvana right away, live in the peace of nirvana, but yet, in spite of that strong aspiration, we find all kinds of conflicts arising within us. And so, just notice all your attempts, your willful attempts to resolve your internal conflicts, and how frustrating it is until you learn to be more patient. And patience always allows then a willingness to accept differences and disparities and allows us to even accept things that we don't want or don't like. Patience isn't just gritting your teeth and just kind of in a negative way. It's a willingness to let things take their natural course, to not try to push or force or do things according to one's own desire. In monastic life, or when you look at our life here in this community, where we have such high standard of morality, and people are basically very good, well-intentioned, trustworthy, and honest, and so forth, and yet conflicts still arise. And so you can see why the world is the way it is, because even among the best of people, there are still problems, even among the saints. I wonder about a couple of arahants get together, what happens? They argue about maybe Jada Vimuti or Panya Vimuti. Liberation through the heart, or liberation through wisdom, which is the best? Is Panya Vimuti higher? Or But then when the resolution does take place, I feel like the resolution between Ajahn and myself is really, it's complete. I don't feel it has any kind of problem. The problem has been resolved, and in a way that seems to be acceptable to both of us. So it seemed to take its time, but when the resolution came, it seems to be really well done, because this past week, I've had very good talks and much a deeper understanding of where each other is coming from. And these you learn through time. You can't just pick it up through a willful act. If I like just getting older, this being my age, is much more patient in life, because you've seen how you've just experienced so much suffering through impulsivity or impatience, through willful acts. Also, you recognize the infinite variety and differences that exist on the conditioned realm. Remember when I first started meditation, I didn't realize how different everybody was from myself. I was the kind of criterion for everything, and I assumed that everybody was like me, with only to the shock realize that most people weren't like me at all. I used to get bewildered. Why does he act like that? Why does she do that? I wouldn't do that, anything like that. Why wouldn't say anything like that? And I'd get very... I could be quite critical and judgmental and get it totally wrong, just because thinking that I am the standard to work from. So in meditation, this reflective ability of the mind to observe. Like the analytical ability tends to get stuck in itself. So when you just think and try to analyze and figure everything out according to reason and logic, then you can get very narrow-minded and very rigid views of everything, right and wrong and good and bad, in terms of principles and high standards and ideals. And so that is when you think too much, then you lack, like if you're attached to ideas, you lack sensitivity. I mean, or the sensitivity can't work through it because you're attached to ideas which are not sensitive. Ideas don't feel anything, even though they're pure and they're high. They're totally without any sensibility. So attachment to something that doesn't feel anything brings us into that state of rather where we blind ourselves with our idealism. And do not understand the things that are happening to us in the sense realm. And then the mindfulness allows us to use our idealism in a way that isn't through attachment. We get to understand, you know, how what the thinking process is for, how to use it, the perceptions, conceptions and so forth, rather than just be totally identified and bound and caught into these our own ideas, views, memories, concepts. Like pointing to feeling, isn't it? It's to open to the experience of sensitivity. I found this a great challenge because I like to think. I like intellectual things, and I quite enjoy all that. Great, avid reader, and ever since I learned to read, I had my nose in a book most of the time. And when you like books better than people, then. More interesting than people, I used to think, because the ideas and the kind of ideas were interesting. And dealing with people, it's a different experience, isn't it? Because then you're having to open to open the sensitive side of yourself. So when we like living in a community, isn't it? And it allows us to develop a sensitivity we wouldn't have if we just lived, say, by ourselves, maybe our world of ideas. Because in any relationship between two individuals or a family or a community or sangha, then this isn't working on ideals or principles or values, but on the reality of the experience of sense of feeling, of atmosphere, of things that are not so clear cut as thoughts. Because feeling isn't a rational function. And that emotions, feelings, and all this are what they are, but they're not, you know, and you try to judge them from the intellect, you can, oftentimes you think, you know, you get confused because maybe you don't want to feel the way you do. And there's often, with many of us, there's been a tremendous war going on between our principles, our ideals, and our feelings. And so we can have very high standards and principles to work from, and then hate ourselves because our feelings are not like that. So we have, I think in psychology they call it the superego, or this inner tyrant. I refer to it as an inner tyrant, a kind of thing in myself that is very critical and judgmental, especially around the realm of feeling. It's very clear on how things should be, on how everybody should be, how the community should be, how the world should be, how I should be, how a good bhikkhu should be, how a good abbot of a monastery should be, and on like this. And so the shoulds of this of the mind come forth, because we can imagine, you know, we've got the intelligence to know that how we should be. Then the realities of how we actually are feeling in the moment is rarely up to that standard. So you can be quite disparaging, self-disparaging, critical, and tyrannical towards yourself. So if you hold to the view you shouldn't be selfish, you should be filled with loving kindness and unselfishness, and then you feel selfish, what happens? And if you're a great idealist and you value those principles very much, then the inner tyrant starts telling you how awful, how terrible you are, because you shouldn't be like, you shouldn't be selfish. You should be selfless. Selfishness is disgusting, and there's something wrong with you, and you shouldn't be like that. And so this internal tyrant can you know, make a strong case of that makes you feel like hopeless and worthless. With mindfulness, then, that's why I keep emphasizing, mindfulness holds both the intellect and the feeling. If we're just caught in feeling without, a very developed sense of what should be, or high, or moral standards, or ideals, then we're just kind of lost in fumbling around in this realm of lost in the kind of amorphousness of just the passions or feelings that arise and cease. So we can easily be just swayed this way or that way, or confused, because feeling isn't very, it changes and it doesn't have the clear-cut edges and the nice defined form of intellect. So, with mindfulness, then this allows the feeling and the intellect to integrate, to work together. So, like, let's say morality, for example, we have the vinaya and the sense of moral commitment to doing good and refraining from doing bad things. So, in this way, what commitment to moral principles, moral precepts is about. We make a determination to refrain from doing things that are divisive, intentionally divisive, harmful, dishonest, exploiting, taking advantage of others, causing heedlessness, and we determine to do what is good. And be kind and generous and so forth towards others in the society. So, to do good and to refrain from doing evil. So this is the moral standard that we hold to. So then mental conditions, sometimes we have evil thoughts, nasty feelings, childish emotions, and so forth, and then we can become very critical and disparaging of ourselves for having these, rather than seeing that these are what they are. You know, we're looking at them in terms of what that they arise. If they arise, they cease. Their nature is impermanent. We're looking at them in terms of Dhamma, rather than in terms of whether they're good or bad. In terms of action and speech, then we act on them if they impel us towards skillful actions, or we refrain from acting or speaking on them if it leads towards division or harm, violence, dishonesty. But the knowing is transcending good and evil. This mindfulness is the ability to transcend the duality of right and wrong, good and evil. That's why you can be aware of your principles and ideals and emotions and feelings at the same time, because the mindfulness is not dividing anything, not favoring one over the other. So this is why the refuge of Buddha, Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. So taking refuge in the Buddha allows us to learn from what the karma that we have. So each of us has our own peculiar karma. Why do I have to be this way? Why can't, you know, I can think of, used to feel so critical of myself that I used to admire others and wish, why couldn't I be like that? Why do I have to be like this? Why do I have to react like this? And then you look at somebody else, you don't know what's going on inside, but you can project all kinds of things onto them, and you can admire them. They look so calm and so together. Why can't I be like that? Because I feel all over the place. And then you go and ask them, and you find somebody sitting there looking so arahant-like in a calm state. You ask what's going on in their mind. And they say, oh, it's just terrible fear. Lust has been going. And so you're quite surprised. You think, well, it didn't show that. It's an inscrutable appearance, you know. In fact, one of the monks in Wat Nanachat in the early days, when Ajahn Manindu and I were together at Wat Nanachat, one of the monks there had this saint-like look. He'd sit there and just be so impeccably calm-looking. Didn't seem to get flustered and caught up into things like the rest of us. Then we found out he was crazy. It all disappeared one day, and he started going absolutely mad. They chasing after the village women, and it was really embarrassing. I think over the past 10 years too, there's just because of the conflicts and the questioning of Sangha life here in England, it in many ways it's been very painful and difficult, but in other ways it's also stimulated a more kind of intense look at what needs to be done, how to deal with conflict, with problems in a community, how to develop. And this isn't just an easy answer, you know, just you can go to experts and try to get everybody's opinion, but it's really, in the long run, we have to resolve this ourselves. So one feels in a community here, you know, there's much more skill now in dealing with personal problems and relation problems between individual members of the community. So for them, much more mature and careful and skillful ways of dealing with emotional problems or differences of character or people not understanding each other, different attitudes, different assumptions, different hopes. So the at times times where things seem to be oftentimes most difficult or trying, or through that, you know, if you either sink or swim, you're going to not make it, or you are. So I found that I'm quite a survivor. I can keep going in the thick of it, and learning, and then find the strength also of a confidence, an increasing confidence that comes through learning, through adversity and difficulty and disappointment. When I became a monk, my expectations were very different. I wasn't really thinking in terms of community. I didn't join the Sangha in order to join a community. I had no interest in community, actually. So it just never occurred to me that was a thing of importance. My interest was in the liberation. I'm intensely interested in realizing the deathless, and so anything around that was just my, you know, my what I really, what interested me, and what I would devote my time to. So in the first year when I was a Samanera, I had some very profound insights. And I was alone almost the whole year in this little kuti. And went through so a kind of a lot of things that emotional. When you're alone like that, then there's nobody to talk to, no distractions, and you find yourself, you're going mad half the time. You know, really, the things that you've held down, the unacknowledged fears and anger and that will start surfacing. And so the first few months was kind of horrific, actually. And then, after a while, I began to get some perspective on it. And then, towards the end of the year, I was in a state of bliss so much of the time. I used to think, I'm never going to leave this monastery. I think I'll stay here the rest of my life. And then, of course, I realized that I needed training. The monastery I lived in, they didn't train you very well, and I was still a samanera, so I wanted to. I knew I should become a bhikkhu and learn to. I needed to learn how to live under authority. And being an American, you're not very good at that. You know, you really don't like authority, and so. And I could see that I didn't know how to deal with it. You can see Americans, because of the egalitarian ideal of American society, it's always wanting to make everything equal, you know, so you're bringing down authority figures to be kind of chummy and pals and things like that. You don't You don't want to look to somebody in kind of in a respectful way. You want to kind of be friendly and familiar right away. And because in the society we're not, we have no way of dealing with authority that in terms of showing respect to it. That's not part of the program. So in terms of going choosing a monastery, I chose deliberately a very strict monastery with the Vinaya, because I didn't like Vinaya either. I don't like all these fussy little rules and all this kind of nitpicking around rules. And I found it really irritating and repulsive. And so I realized I needed to learn how to do that, how to conform, how to consider things in a different way, how to obey somebody else, how to lower myself and be someone who was serving somebody. So then when I had that insight, then I met this monk that took me to Ajahn Chah. And so it was quite intentional. It wasn't that I deliberately chose. I could have chosen a much easier life, because I was being offered all kinds of opportunities where I could get my way. I was a big Farang, a big American, and I could, certain places would just let me get away with whatever I wanted to do. But I didn't want that. I knew that would be a waste, because the aim was a spiritual realization, not convenience for myself as a person. So this training in with Lungpo Cha then was a very important period of life. I began to really enjoy the life of Tudong monk in the style of the Thai forest tradition, and I began to really enjoy the conformity of it and feel very much at ease within it. And then as I was getting very much adjusted to the Thai forest tradition, then the Westerners started coming. And they pushed all the buttons that weren't being pushed by the Thais. Because the Westerners were always complaining, always, had so many opinions and views about everything. And we're always challenging everything, and questioning everything. And I found such an aversion to foreign monks that after my fifth vasa, I made a quick exit and ran away for a year. I didn't want to have to train Western monks, because they were bringing up, I was angry and frustrated and just the endless hassles of all their doubts and questions. So then the sixth year I went to Tudong in India, and then I had this experience while in India of gratitude to Lungpo Cha. Had a strong sense of katanyu, gatawaiti, or gratitude. And so then I realized that I just kind of, in a kind of cowardly way, just left, and that I had this insight I should go back and try to help, because I was at that time there were an increased amount of Westerners coming, and I was the only one at the time that could speak the language. So after that I went back. Went back from India, went back to Wat Pa Phong and offered myself to Lungpo Cha, said, use me as you will. So then, what on my heart started happening, and I became inextricably bound to Western Sangha. So this, the Western mind is very questioning and critical, and so this and trying to, you know, it puts you on a defensive. At first, I was always trying to be defending the Thai forest tradition or the use of Vinaya or the tradition, because there's all this questioning and comparing and other ideas and ideals, and so I found myself always in a position of being a defender of it and trying to kind of justify it in every way. So then through the years, just learning to just observe, you know, just trusting in awareness to see how, you know, what's that, what I'm actually doing, the way I do react. Not not to be critical, but just to notice how when somebody starts attacking or questioning the value of Theravada Buddhism, how immediately I could get very defensive or feel threatened. I could feel, you know, people would start questioning me. And then I'd get very defensive and feel threatened, and then with mindfulness began to notice these reactions. How when things, there are certain subjects that I found very threatening, and when these subjects would be brought up, I'd feel incredibly, I could feel myself shake with fear. So I remember years ago at Tham Sang Pet, when we had Vipakaro was there, he was a novice then, and Santajito, Steve Saslav, he was there, and they were both seminaries, and then there was a German monk and an English monk and an American, because we spent the Vasa together at this Tham Sang Pet, and anyway, Santajito was into a lot of these confrontational therapies, and he'd been a devoted disciple of this Maslov, who was a psychiatrist, and so I remember he arranged to have a kind of meeting where we were going to have confrontation. I was never so scared in my life. And so, anyway, we had a meeting. Nothing much happened, but I remember being absolutely panic-stricken before, you know, thinking about it. Well, they're going to criticize me. They're going to, you know, tell me what's wrong. They're going to tell me things I don't want to hear. And they're going to reject me, or all of these kind of anxieties would arise in consciousness. But it didn't work very well. Nothing all that severe happened. But I do remember how anxiety ridden I was over just the idea of having to being confronted by somebody else with criticism or challenging me in some way. Because in the hierarchical structure, I could feel comfortable through being senior and kind of being the kind of one that, you know, teaches and defends the tradition and instructs. And that was quite, I could quite get on with that one. But when it came into challenging, then something in me was not very well developed for being challenged. Or question, or criticize. So you begin to be aware of these weak points, Because in the Four Noble Truths, you know, dukkha is the first one. So I'd use that. Why am I so upset? Why do I fear or feel so anxious? If somebody criticizes, why do I feel so threatened by criticism? And then to begin to put that in a context of desire and attachment. Just to observe, to investigate it, and what am I attached to? What kind of desire am I attached to that makes me suffer like this? So this is a, like self-inquiry, inquiring into this. You begin to see, you know, that how the ego operates, how you see yourself as through the ego all the time. And through ideas and perceptions, and when those perceptions are challenged or criticized, then you feel very threatened, and or you feel offended or hurt or upset by it, because your identity is with the conditions of the mind, with the perception. So using this Four Noble Truths, I developed a lot of meditation around non-attachment, realizing where the emptiness of the mind, or the cessation of conditions, or this spaciousness of the mind, or the stillness, or the silence. So that, because this tends to be ignored if you're just so obsessed with yourself as an ego, as a person, as a personality. And all you can see yourself in terms of whether you're right or wrong, good or bad, or respected or not respected, or whatever, then it just, if that's all you know, then life is a very, you know, anxiety-ridden experience. So in getting to feel at ease with anatta, or not being, with stillness, with silence. And that took quite a strong determination, because it doesn't seem like anything. It's interesting sometimes to analyze yourself. Why do I get frightened over being criticized? And why do I feel threatened when this happens? And then I say, well, you know, I never had a proper bonding with my father, and I never did with this and that. And I'm born under the sign of Leo, and I have four planets in Cancer. No, like that. And it's incredibly interesting to do that. Where stillness is not very interesting, is it? But it is, once you begin to recognize it, realize it, then you realize the way of non-suffering. And it is not a stillness or silence of annihilation. It's not like an atomic blast that destroys everything or sterilizes everything inside. But it lets things, it allows us a perspective of non-attachment. So we can begin to realize or recognize suffering, its causes, and the absence of suffering. I think one of the big problems that people have, you talk to most Western people at least, is fear of being rejected. Of not being, you know, being looked down on or rejected by others. And so this it seems to be a common problem for all of us. So lot of fear and anxiety around relating to each other, fear of being rejected. I'm sure many of you are frightened I'm going to reject you. Or and I still think I get sometimes consumed because I think you're going to reject me, so it works both ways. So this rejection is something, is a habit, emotional habit, or a condition that we have that we can begin to recognize. So just the fear of being rejected is, just by using that term, I can kind of be more aware of that feeling, being self-conscious, feeling that somebody's not going to approve or like me, or they're going to dismiss me or disrespect me or reject me in some way. It's like this. And just by noticing that feeling, don't need to know why or analyze it, but just recognize that as a mental state, then the knowing of that state, that you're seeing it in terms of an object of the mind, because feeling fear of rejection is a mental object, not the subject, is it? It arises and ceases. You don't feel that all the time, but it comes and goes. So you're establishing the awareness, which is the pure subject, that they then can see the object. And as you develop confidence in that, then the objects are definitely objects. You're not making them the subject anymore. If you don't know that, then you tend to make the object the subject. You think, oh, I am somebody with a great fear of being rejected, and I'm insecure, and I have low self-esteem, and then you become the object rather than the subject, because you've allied yourself with an emotion or a mental habit that you're totally identified with. So if you trust in the pure subject, which is pure awareness, which is mindfulness, pure consciousness, then you can put this sense of I'm somebody who fears rejection in terms of what it really is. It's a condition, an object of the mind rather than what you really are, or it's not really yours. It is what it is, though. It's like this. We're not just missing it, saying it's not mine, but we're totally accepting it for what it is, and it's like this. We see it as a aramana, or a mental object, rather than making it our self. So this is what we mean by sati sampajanya, sati panya. Investigating things like this, then really, as you explore it more and more, then you gain more confidence. Because you can kind of get the idea, but then if you don't really put it into practice, you fall back into the old habits, because the old habits are easiest. Even if they're bad habits, they're what you're used to. And then bad habit might, say smoking is hazardous for your health. The signboards in London, huge cigarette advertisements, and underneath is huge letters, smoking is hazardous to your health. But and it's a bad habit, but it's what you're used to. So even if it's hazardous to your health, it's still easier to smoke than not to. So habits are like that, they're what we're used to, so it's easy to just to fall back into doing the old habits of self-view, worry, anxiety, and all the rest. It's so easy just to do that, because that's what we're used to. So in Satipanya, Satisampajanya, it's like this awakening state. So we find ourselves back in the old habits, and then suddenly we realize, got lost again. So we awaken, we get a feeling for the sense of awakenness. It's not like samadhi where you're intensely concentrated. It's a simple state of just attentiveness to the present. And to really value that. See, it's not just a momentary flash of something, but it's sustainable. As you value it and treasure it, it's a natural state. It has a continuity. It's not created. It's not something that depends on conditions supporting it. So Satisampajanya is something we can use all the time, even in the battlefield, in the midst of a storm, on top of a mountain, or waiting in a queue, or sitting in the temple, sitting alone in your kuti, or when you're sick with a cold and pneumonia, when the world around you is falling apart. Satisampajanya is always our potential. It's always, it's never, nothing makes that impossible except our forgetting of it. When we forget and get lost in the momentum, in the movement of our old habits. So this is why on this retreat, just encouraging this kind of exploration, so that you really, hopefully will increase your confidence in this, and see how, and be more confident in how to use it, how to learn from the way you experience life, the way you particularly are, the kind of emotional habits and attitudes and that you have. Because we learn from the way we are. I can't learn from the way somebody else is. And so even if you may not like the way you are, I think this is what you have to learn from. Or you meet people with disabilities and have all kinds of, rather unfortunate things. And yet, if they're willing to learn from the way they are, then there's enlightenment, there's wisdom. They don't even need to be healthy or strong or beautiful or clever or anything. These things are not the important issues in this path. It's this awakened awareness. So I have to learn from this, from the way this thing is. This is the body. This is what there is. This person, this character, this physical form, and whether it's all whether I like it or don't, or like parts or not, or whatever, it doesn't make a difference, because this is what I'm learning from this. These five khandhas. So then you can stop admiring others and thinking, I wish I were like so and so. That's foolish, isn't it? Because that's a waste of time to go thinking, wishing you were like somebody else. Because it's obviously this is what you learn from this. So you don't need to be like somebody else. You're just willing to learn from the way you are, what you, the conditions that you're experiencing. Now, like in the reflective mind, you can see like crazy states of mind, like I've had in you know, really quite mad state sometimes of going through my consciousness. But because I can reflect on that, then I don't get caught in that. But if you don't reflect, then you tend to believe you're crazy and would get attached to things, get frightened by it rather than willing to reflect on it. So that's why in the sense of refuge, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, see that emphasizing this sense of refuge is, you know, trusting in the ability to pay attention to what the mental objects are. If they're reasonable and good mannered and polite and beautiful, or they're rough and coarse and dirty and filthy, or they're crazy and mad. Your refuge is in the awareness, not in trying to sort it all out, control and get rid of and get involved, but to be able to have the confidence to just see it's like this. The mental objects, the aramana, are like this. And then, like, if you keep doing it, then you begin to really have a sense of being this pure presence. But it's like you can't find it. You have to be it. You can't see yourself being purely present. Where is it, you know? Yeah. Am I purely present now or not? I don't know, somebody tell me. But it's not a matter of finding it, but of being it, trusting in just this imminent, simple imminent act of awakened attention to the present. So here we are now, the sound of silence, breath, body. It's like we can call it witnessing. And it's like you, because of witness, there's a knowing. It's not critical, and that awareness isn't saying anything about what should or shouldn't be. It's not. It's the way it is. So this allows us to witness even to terrible things, mental states, and that. Without judging them, without saying we shouldn't have them, or I don't want this. Or if this is what we do, then we're aware of our own kind of emotional habits of rejecting or resisting or struggling against things. We can just see what's actually taking place, because we're now in a very safe place of Buddhang Saranagacchami, of being in the state of pure knowing, pure consciousness. Where even the most unpleasant emotional states or horrible states can be accepted for what they are. They are what they are. This moment, things can only be what they are, isn't it? Let's contemplate that. You know, at this moment, pleasant or unpleasant it is, it can only be this way because this is the way it is. You know, irrefutable. But then the thinking mind says, I don't want it to be this way. Then you're adding something on to it, you know. I don't want life to be like this. But in terms of sati sampajanya, then if this is the way life is, and we're not saying this is the way life is as if it's always like this, because it's not, isn't it? But at this moment, this is the way it is. And so whatever way it is isn't really important. The important thing is to recognize this is the way it is. It's an honest admission of things, and you know, it's not trying to say something that isn't the way, you know, or that trying to paint a different picture or deny or justify anything, but to recognize, to realize. So this refuge then is a transcendent knowing. And it allows us to embrace feeling and thinking and all the rest, the desires, the instinctual desires, the body itself, the passions, the instinctual desires of the body, the mental states, emotions, whatever. Because our relationship to all that is through sati sampajanya rather than through principles, ideals of how things should be. So, offer this as a reflection for this evening, and then this next week, another week of this formal retreat. And I'm apologize in the mornings I haven't been here. I fully intended to be, but I felt more important business at that time. A reconciliation would be take the priority, and so that gives me a lot of joy actually to be. Have good relationship with Ajahn Manindra is very important to both of us. And also because we're both concerned the welfare of the Sangha here in Europe, and recognizing a real sincere intention on both of us to work together and support each other more, and an honesty, a directness that we can develop a trusting relationship, which will benefit the Sangha in general, as well as ourselves. So this is I think good news actually, considering this is the beginning of the year, beginning of the winter's retreat. Having started the retreat with the eclipse of the moon, which I found is inauspicious. The eclipse of the moon and the red moon is an inauspicious sign, I was determined to make it auspicious. Maybe I've got a very powerful mind. But anyway, it's certainly a good beginning. And also, to recognize that conflict will arise both internally and externally, and they do resolve. You know, as we trust in Dhamma and be patient with ourselves and with life in general, these things can be resolved. But maybe they aren't resolved as soon as we want. But that's where patience is necessary, rather than wanting to get it over as quickly as possible. Sometimes we have to bear with things for long periods of time till the time comes for its resolution. So I offer this as a reflection.